Ladies and gentlemen, Eric Davis.
So I don't have a paper prepared. I'm going to mostly riff on ideas about dreams and books and what I think of as the sort of, I'll go so far as to say the paranormal dimension of PKD's writing. But I say that, and I want to insist from the beginning, not in a spiritualist or supernatural or mystical sense. I'm interested in talking about how the mysteries of his writing and how it influences people, sometimes in very interesting ways, is a function of the way that he writes. And so I'd really like to insist from the beginning that I am going to stay on the level of writing and literature and dreaming and psychology, but that while I'll be describing or gesturing towards religious or mystical possibilities, that I prefer to think of them as sort of speculative things that we deal with kind of in their own terms. But I'd like to start off talking about a parallel that I think is very, very interesting and actually goes rather deep the more you think about it, that will set up some of this my main issue of this circular relationship between writing and dreaming. And that is to compare Phil Dick to a pulp writer from the first half of the 20th century, H.P. Lovecraft. And there was a number of very interesting correspondences between these gentlemen. You know, during their lives, they were generally quite poor. They wrote for pulps. They had extreme intellectual aspirations. They corresponded enormously. And they were largely, you know, ignored through their life from the larger field of culture and intelligentsia, and are now canonized. I love Patrick's comment that in the 21st century we're going to read Raymond Chandler, Lovecraft, and Dick, and those are going to be the most important American writers. And I think we're halfway there already. And you know, like Dick, Lovecraft was enshrined in a Library of America volume, kind of the great sign of upper middle brow canonization in American letters. But there's more interesting things that come out of this than just those two correspondences. I want to talk a little bit about the loop between the sort of metafictional magic of Lovecraft. And part of it has to do with the way that his books loop dreaming and writing. And just to give you a little highlight of what I mean by this is that I'm very interested in the way that texts refer to writing, the way that texts refer to other kinds of texts. And what I believe is there's a sort of game that gets going, and you see it in Lovecraft, and you see it very much in Dick. Even The Squib is an example of some of this, where the way that these texts refer to other texts sets up certain kinds of relationships that end up parasiting the reader and the way that we read that text, creating an open-ended labyrinth of reference that we sort of, kind of fall into, get absorbed into, get seduced into. It's like the way that Laura referred to the grasshopper lies heavy inside the context of The Man in the High Castle. Well, which is the real book? And the one book is quoting this other book, and then what you get is a circuit of reference that's open-ended and that draws us into that circuit in some way or another. Some people take it very seriously, some people just enjoy it as a game, but it's something that's an effect of the way that the literature is produced. Lovecraft does something similar, and as I will argue, part of the reasons that Lovecraft's influence is similar to Dick's in a number of ways I'll point out has to do with this game. Probably the best example of within the literature is the novella Shadow Out of Time. And if you're not familiar with that, the basic setup is there's a guy named Peasley, who's like many of his protagonists, an educated man. And he basically is has essentially amnesia for many years. He's taken over by some other kind of creature or entity who goes around and does things and performs as if he's a human being, and then suddenly Peasley wakes back up, and it's many years later, and they're telling him, yeah, you were acting pretty weird there for a while. then he starts having these dreams, and these dreams seem to tell him over and over and over again about this time period, sometime in the Earth's past, where there is this other incoming race of these completely bizarre-looking creatures, the Ithians, who have like these big tubular bodies, and they're really absurd-looking. And in this dream, the world is telling him that what this race does is it body snatches other races from other times and draws those beings into its world and sends an emissary out to the other world. And while those snatched beings are in the great race's world, they spend all their time writing about their own world. So in this dream, he's sitting there writing about what Earth was like and what his life is like, and so he's just sort of recording his own experience. But this is just happening to him in this weird series of dreams. And as is typical with Lovecraft book, the reader figures it out long before the protagonist. It's like, well, clearly this actually happened, and then what's going to happen at the end of the novels or the novellas, we're going to find out that it actually happened, and I can't believe that the protagonist can't figure it out. But in this one, it's actually it's a particularly beautiful way that this individual who's haunted by these dreams finally discovers the truth, which is they discover this underground city in Australia, and he goes down there, and then one night he's wandering alone, and he gets lost, and it's really spooky, and he finds his way down into this, you know, ancient alien kind of architecture, and he's whining, and then finally it's all very familiar, and oh, he finds this big library, and then he pulls down this very familiar-looking book, and he opens it up, and there's his own handwriting. His own handwriting. So it's a wonderful novella that shows this circular relationship of writing and dreaming. Now that's within the story. That's a little metafictional game within the story. But of course, in Lovecraft's own life, there's a loop between writing and dreaming, because some of Lovecraft's fiction is based on his extremely rich and quite horrifying dream life. Lovecraft had nightmares his whole life. They are rooted in a very difficult and traumatic upbringing, which we can also in some ways link with Bill Dix. And some of his stories are direct dream transcriptions. And in general, the sense of dreaming that appears in his text is in a way an autobiographical reflection of his own dream life. Now, one of the things that I think happens with this effect of this particular way of an author writing himself into, or herself, into the novels is that we become fascinated with them in a particular way. We become, in a way, almost too intimate with aspects of their psychology. This is not the same thing as an author drawing from like the story of his girlfriend and how he went, you know, town he was raised in, and then his experience in the Navy, and then they change it a little bit, and you know, that's very common. This is something very specific, a kind of psychological intimacy. Now, what happens with Lovecraft's fiction after he dies? Well, there's a number of interesting things that happen. One is that immediately, in fact, already during his life, partly through his own encouragement, his friends and then other people who didn't know him begin to write Lovecraft fiction. In some sense, Lovecraft is not a fantasy writer or a horror writer. Lovecraft creates his own genre, Lovecraft fiction, and people start writing within that fiction. At the same time, Lovecraft himself becomes a very important figure in a fan's life. Anybody who's really interested in Lovecraft's fiction is very interested in Lovecraft, knows a lot about his life. Reproductions of Lovecraft stories will often feature Lovecraft on the cover. Now, you can see where I'm going with this. This is very, very similar to Phil Dick. If you get into Phil Dick, even just sort of passively, you know about Phil Dick's life. 2374 is part of your fictional experience of Phil Dick, and the same thing also happened with reprints and around the mid-80s, I think those Blu-ray ones were some of the first where we start to see Phil Dick's face regularly on the cover of the book. So part of what we're doing is we're entering into a world that is not just a fiction. It's about the way a fiction functioned in a real person's life, and even further, the way that the fiction and the nonfiction break down. There's some kind of ambiguity there. In the case of Lovecraft, it's like, yes, it's just a dream, but the whole thing about the dream is that the dream is the way that these entities enter in. So by reading Lovecraft's fiction that's actually based on his dreams, I'm kind of teasing myself close to a kind of madness where my very reading of the text is a way that these entities could enter into our reality. And in some ways, that's happened. That Cthulhu, Nyarlathotep, the basic mythos of Lovecraft's universe is widespread. It's a system of reference that permeates the internet and geek culture. Now, most of this is done with enormous jest, but not all of it. There are forms of occult magic where people very seriously invoke these fictional entities, fully aware that they are in some sense fictional, but having different ways of framing their reality or their quasi-reality or their surreality or their irreality or however we want to say it. I would like to suggest that something similar is happening, has been happening with the, let's call it the kind of Valis material. And that becoming interested in Philip K. Dick, one becomes interested in his biography, in his person, many other aspects of his person too. I don't want to say that the 2374 is the most important by any means, but it's certainly the one that's most often rehearsed. Another sign of this is that in any of these sort of mainstream, middle-brow kind of stories that you see in newspapers or in the New Yorker, you know, they're going to talk about his fiction. They're going to spend a good amount of time talking about his life. They're going to talk about suffering, all the too many wives, the drugs, and inevitably 2374. So all of his biographical material, all of our interest in his interviews, even the ways that the biographies, especially Carrier's, kind of uses fictional elements, begins to create this whole sort of realm of kind of quasi-reality. Another way of approaching this is that just as a lot of fans of Lovecraft and followers wrote fiction in that extended his universe, something kind of similar, though to a much less extent, has happened with Phil Dick stuff, particularly after he died. And this is the great motif that Phil Dick is not really exactly dead, but he's actually still writing texts through other people, or people are writing texts where Phil Dick is a character in it, or Phil Dick is coming from the other side of the veil in order to inspire us, etc., etc. And so what you're happening is that these fictions, EJ can talk about this quite directly, that these fictions are structurally mimicking Dick's own relationship with the beyond. So Dick's own relationship with Bishop Pike, you know, to go back and just do a little bit of biography, Pike is this renegade Episcopalian bishop of the diocese in California. He rejects many conventional concepts of Christianity to the point of basically being a heretic. He's also very interested in the paranormal. His son dies. He begins to do seances, and Dick and Nancy go to some of these seances. And then when when Pike dies in 70, I believe, this was a big event in Dick's life, and that when after 2374 goes down, a lot of his first writing about what's happening to him, the sense that, as in the Lovecraft story, a different personality is taking him over and actually moving his car and moving him through the day, very similar to A Shadow Out of Time in this sense, that a lot of his initial ideas is this is actually James Pike. And that I'm more rational. I know things I didn't know. I'm actually moving through the world differently because Pike has come through from across the veil and is in some ways animating me or parasiting me. And that goes away as he goes deeper into the kind of metaphysics of it. But I think it's very important that his first sort of his kind of movement into this metaphysical weirdness occurs through his relationship with Pike and the way that Pike was a real person who was interested in seances, et cetera, et cetera. So what these fictions are doing when they're sort of saying Philip K. Dick is not dead, or Philip K. Dick is actually writing a story, or all these metafictional games, which are done often with a good deal of humor, of a kind of geeky self-referentiality, like a lot of the Lovecraft stuff, but there's something more serious going on, or at least the reason that people do that is because they want to draw or reflect a certain kind of power that Dick had already set up in his text in terms of the way that he related to these other forces. Now, another way of kind of saying this then is that the fictional universe of Lovecraft and the fictional universe of Phil Dick do not die with the author's death. They move forward. They continue to reproduce themselves in different fashion through different media. With the Phil Dick stuff, you can talk very much about the way that certain aspects of his universe have gone on to infect Hollywood filmmaking in a very interesting way, which I'm not going to go into. You know, what films are really Phil Dickian? Not that many, but there are certain elements that have gone in, so much so that in essence, if you see a reality breakdown film now that's made in Hollywood, even a film like Inception, which makes no overt reference to Phil Dick, is not based on any Phil Dick story, in some sense, it's irreducibly Phil Dickian, that you can't get Dick out of the equation anymore. And that infectious quality is what I'm drawing to and why Lovecraft is such a great example, because you can see something very similar. And it's drawing off metaphors of the supernatural, of different dimensions of reality, of different kinds of time. There's some very interesting similarities. But I mentioned that I really wanted to talk about it in terms of literature, in terms of strategies of writing. And so having, I think, established that there's a kind of life to these texts, to this fictional universe, to this way of organizing reality, we can say, what kind of life is it? And I'd say that there's two very different models. One, to use Dick's own language, it's the logos. That there's something, there's a kind of life of information, a life of meaning that animates the universe, that can touch authors, that can touch texts, but it's much larger than that. It has to do with the nature of reality itself, or the novel producing the liveliness of reality is carried through this kind of logos, which can change us, which can enter into us, renew us in a Christian metaphor, that part of what's happening with the conversion experience is that we are renewed inside because we've touched this kind of life that is sort of abstract, is sort of very real, very, very embodied. So on the one hand, we have this kind of positive religious metaphor of the logos, the living word. And on the other side of the scale, we have a very different metaphor of the virus. The virus, what is a virus? Virus, like David Gill's zombies, like the androids, is neither living nor dead. It really is, to the degree that it's not purely dead, it's because it's a bunch of DNA that reproduces itself. And if our definition of life goes to a bunch of DNA, i.e. just information that reproduces itself, then we have to say viruses are alive. If we want to say that things actually have to have a body or some kind of inside-outside in order to define them as life, then viruses aren't really alive. So the virus is a very powerful metaphor for talking about the way that language, literature, writing influence us, influence society. There's, of course, the very popular and often poorly deployed and in some ways very dumb idea of the meme that I think many of you are familiar with. This is an idea that comes out of a very strongly neo-Darwinian, i.e. DNA-centered view of the world in which we can understand, metaphorically they claim, although many of them go right ahead and literalize it, we can understand culture, consciousness, psychology, ideas, religions, motivations as memes or memeplexes, meaning little bits of information that we reproduce because that's all we really know how to do. Just the same way that DNA reproduces itself, these ideas, whether they're fads or dance steps or slang terms or viral things on the internet, they want to reproduce and we're the hosts of their reproduction.